What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. In the coming months, there's going to be an absolute onslaught of news coming out of the criminal trials of Donald Trump, the first American president to be indicted. Today, the first one begins, and it is a saucy one. And 150 years ago today, an art movement got its start. As so often with revolutions in the arts, at first, critics and pundits didn't have a great impression of the Impressionists. First up, though. Iran had promised it for days and days, and on Saturday, it delivered. A barrage of about 300 armed drones and long-range missiles set off for Israel, retaliation for an Israeli airstrike 2 weeks ago. Israelis and Palestinians alike watched explosions over the skies of the Holy Land, but that was pretty much it. An overwhelming majority of the threats were intercepted by Israel and its partners, including America and Britain. Iran's historic attack ended up causing little damage and, as yet, no deaths. As the drones made their way toward Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that whoever hurts us, we hurt him.
אני יודע שגם אתם אזרחי ישראל שומרים על קור רוח. אני קורא לכם לשמוע להנחיות פיקוד העורף. יחד נעמוד.
But in the attack's aftermath, world leaders called for calm. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said it was time to defuse and de-escalate.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
Restraint is not Mr. Netanyahu's forte, as the war in Gaza makes clear. Yet Iran's salvo, however ineffective, was an enormous provocation.
This is a massive deal. We've had decades of tough talk and fighting between Iran and Israel in terms of their proxies, but this is the first time that Iran has attacked Israel directly from its own territory.
Josie Delap is The Economist's Middle East editor.
So the question now is, how does Israel retaliate, and what are the odds of that dragging the region and indeed America into a larger scale war?
But the attacks over the weekend were themselves a retaliation, right?
They were. Israel struck the Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus, the Syrian capital, at the beginning of April, killing a very senior general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And that was a real escalation in Israel's shadow war, which has been going on for many years, against Iranian targets. And we saw, in response to that, the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, saying that the malicious Zionist regime will be punished. So this is coming in the context of a mounting tension between the two countries.
And so in the event then Israel kind of knew this was coming, how did it play out?
So Israel has had a couple of weeks fundamentally to prepare for this. I think it knew that Iran was going to respond in some way. The question was whether it would use one of its proxies, like Hezbollah, the militia that's based in Lebanon near Israel's northern border. In the end, it was a direct response for Iran, which is particularly striking because, as I said, that's the first time that we've seen that. Iran ended up launching around 300 drones and missiles. But the fact that Israel had this time to prepare and that there was a certain amount of signalling from Iran in terms of what the nature of the attack was going to be meant that Israel was ready for it. And lots of other countries helped in the defence. America, the UK, France, Jordan shot down some of the missiles over its own airspace. And there was some involvement from Gulf states like Saudi Arabia that was more indirect. And there wasn't actually any substantial damage. There was a bit of damage to Nevatim air base in the south of Israel, and there was one casualty, a Bedouin girl. But fundamentally, this was not a devastating attack.
And what do you make of those numbers? What sounded like a huge response here, but ultimately one that didn't cause a lot of damage?
Right. So Iran needed to have a Goldilocks response, one that was big enough to enforce its sense of deterrence, but not so big that it provoked a huge retaliation from Israel or indeed Israel's allies. I think you've got to look at this in the context of what is going on in the region as well, in particular the war in Gaza. And one of the things to remember is that before this, the pressure on Israel in terms of its war in Gaza from its allies, from the international community, had really been ratcheting up. There were people talking about whether or not weapons supplies to Israel should be limited in some way. There was intensifying criticism of the way that Israel has prosecuted this war. And as a result of the strikes against Israel from Iran, you've now seen a real rallying round of Israel's Western supporters. And so that has really shifted, I think, the dynamic in the region. So Iran, I think that arguably it may have sort of squandered its position somewhat. To begin with, it didn't really establish its deterrence. Secondly, Iran very much sets itself up as a defender of the Palestinians. And I think you could have a discussion as to how sincere that is, but whatever your answer to that is, this has pushed Gaza and the plight of the Palestinians down the global agenda. The focus now is on Iran, the extent to which Iran needs to be contained, how you do that. It is much less on Gaza than it was before.
So what about the answer to those questions, how to contain Iran? What do you reckon Israel is going to do?
Well, arguably, the scale of the attack by Iran leaves Israel in a bit of a bind. If it had been a much more damaging attack, I think it would have been clearer that Israel needed to respond in some way, and I think it would have garnered more international support for that. If it had been much smaller, Israel could have merely shrugged it off and said, look at our weak adversary, we don't even need to respond. But now, it's sort of caught in this midway point. But the problem is that it's not clear that Israel can respond without risking all-out war. And you've got America and other Western allies very much telling Israel to exercise restraint. One of the reports from Joe Biden and Netanyahu's conversation was Biden telling Israel to take the win. So the question now is, what is the nature of Israel's response? I think that's not going to be an immediate response, partly because it takes time to plan any kind of attack. And Israel has been preparing for its defense against Iran's strike, and it's working out the political ramifications of whatever it does. In terms of what that response could look like, there's a possibility of drones, of long-range airstrikes on Iran, perhaps on military bases or nuclear installations, or of focusing on Iranian targets elsewhere in the region, as it has done previously in countries like Syria and Iraq, which are less likely to escalate the situation dramatically. Or there's an argument that, as I said, Iran has miscalculated and that Israel waits and allows Iran to make a mistake and doesn't escalate things itself.
But it seems clear that the international community might like for Israel simply to sit on its hands.
Right. I mean, I think the point here is that nobody wants outright war, not even Iran and Israel. And America definitely does not want to get pulled into a large-scale war in the Middle East. There are complicating factors to that, in particular, Netanyahu's considerations. He is in a difficult position domestically. The war in Gaza has not been going well. He's under international pressure. He certainly has the idea that the longer Israel is in a state of war, the easier it is for him to stay in power. And he has always presented Iran as an existential threat to Israel and indeed a threat to the wider world. And so maintaining that position suits him. On the other hand, I think that America and other allies of Israel in the West are conscious that the stronger their response is to Iran and the clearer they are in their support of Israel in this context, the more likely it is that Israel feels able to express restraint in terms of its response to Iran on this particular attack.
But what about Benjamin Netanyahu in particular? Is his view on this going to be a deciding factor in where this ends, do you think?
I mean, the issue with Bibi is never underestimate the extent to which he can make a bad situation worse. His political interests and his sense of the importance of his own political position and maintaining that over the importance of serving Israel's national interests or indeed any wider interest is so powerful. We've seen that throughout this war. We've seen that at different points during his career in Israel that I don't think we can discount it, even though more widely the Israeli establishment and indeed the region and the world does not want to see the Middle East go up in flames.
What's your take on the risk of that right now?
We have been talking about this as though every decision that is made, every calculation is a very precise one, and as though people are making decisions on the basis of knowing what the outcome of those decisions is going to be. And I think one of the dangers in this situation is that we don't, and that people make miscalculations, and that we get surprising outcomes. When we were talking about Israel's attacks on Iranian targets in that shadow war, the approach was always, let's keep ratcheting things up as long as it's going okay, as long as Iran is not responding in a way that becomes devastating for Israel. And that works every time until it doesn't. So the question is just whether these quite dysfunctional governments in Iran and Israel can avoid a full-blown war.
Josie, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
If you flip through the history books, America has seen some questionable behavior from its presidents. Usually these infractions ended up with a name. The Teapot Dome scandal of the 1920s, Watergate, the Iran-Contra affair. But no president was indicted, had ever faced a criminal trial. That was until Donald Trump, who now faces four of them.
Donald Trump has been charged over his handling of classified documents.
Trump has been charged with attempting to overturn his 2020 election.
The former president was indicted for a third time. This time,
there are both state and federal charges on trying to overturn results from the 2020 election and an indictment for hanging on to classified documents at his Florida home. But the first of the four trials to go ahead is perhaps the tawdriest. Mr. Trump, of course, strenuously denies wrongdoing in all of these cases. Well, tell it to the judge.
Of the four criminal cases against Donald Trump, this trial that starts today, it might be the only one that produces a verdict before the election in November.
Kenneth Werner is covering the Trump trials for The Economist.
The trial is going to run for 6 to 8 weeks. There will be a week or two of jury selection. And it's going to be a spectacle, a full media circus. I mean, it's a historic moment, and it's just a very salacious story.
Well, I do love a salacious story. What is this trial actually about?
Okay, so at its root, the story is about sex and money and blackmail. About a month before the 2016 election, a porn star named Stormy Daniels, who says that she had sex with Donald Trump once in 2006, started shopping around her story to news outlets and to tabloids, seeing if anyone would pay for it. Donald Trump denies his story. But this was just after the Access Hollywood tape leaked in the press.
I moved on her like a bitch, but I couldn't get there. And she was married. And all of a sudden, I see...
That was hugely damaging to the Trump campaign. The campaign was in real damage control mode. So basically, it's alleged that Donald Trump and his team got together and decided to buy exclusive rights to Stormy Daniels' story, make her sign a non-disclosure agreement, and bury this story, make sure that the public didn't hear about it before the election. The prosecutor's case hinges on the fact that Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former personal lawyer and his fixer, paid this hush money out of his own pocket.
And why was that detail important here?
So Michael Cohen pays Stormy Daniels $130,000 for her silence. And he does this out of his own pocket, but he says he did this at the direction of Donald Trump. And so prosecutors are saying that Donald Trump and his executives at the Trump Organization decided to pay back Cohen in monthly installments and mark these payments in the ledger book of the Trump Organization as legal expenses to mislabel them. The charge that prosecutors have brought is falsifying business records. The crime centers on this alleged cover-up. Falsifying business records in New York would normally be a misdemeanor. In order to elevate it to a felony, prosecutors have to say that the business records were falsified with intent to commit another crime. And so what's the other crime? Prosecutors have pointed to a few possible ones. That the hush money amounted to a campaign finance violation, and that taxes weren't properly paid on the reimbursements to Michael Cohen. Prosecutors are saying that this hush money was illegal campaign contribution because it wasn't declared and it was made to influence the election, that it was made to help his campaign. Donald Trump denies all wrongdoing, and his lawyers are calling this whole thing a fantasy case.
So is it, though? What is Trump's defense here?
Trump's lawyers will say that there was nothing illegal about the hush money, that it wasn't a undeclared campaign contribution, that Trump did this solely to protect his own reputation, to spare his wife embarrassment, that even political candidates have a right to pace that embarrassing stories about them don't leak to the press, that this would have happened had he not been running for office. Other political candidates have had success making that argument. John Edwards, who ran for president in 2008, was charged with campaign finance violations for paying to cover up the fact that he had had an affair and had a child with the woman he was having an affair with. And a jury acquitted him of the charges. So Trump's lawyers will probably point to that example. But it really won't help that Michael Cohen admitted in a guilty plea with federal prosecutors that this hush money was an illegal campaign contribution.
Today, as you heard, Michael Cohen pled guilty to 8 felony charges.
In 2018, he pled guilty to that along with other crimes, and he spent over a year in jail.
So what Mr. Cohen has said and done and does say this time around will be a real sort of central part of this trial.
Yeah, exactly. This really comes down to who do you believe? Donald Trump or Michael Cohen. Trump's lawyers are going to say that Michael Cohen is a serial liar, that you absolutely can't trust him, that he's lied under oath before, which he has. They will really try to impugn his credibility. Trump's lawyers will also say that Michael Cohen has a vendetta, that Michael Cohen went to prison in 2018, and since then he's wanted revenge against Donald Trump. And the two men do have this long-running animosity towards each other that started in 2018 when Michael Cohen began to attract the attention of the FBI and prosecutors, and Donald Trump stopped paying for Michael Cohen's legal defense. So that's when the two had their falling out. There's a big question of whether Trump will testify. He said just the other day that he would.
Yeah, I would testify, absolutely. It's a scam. It's a scam.
He said in previous civil trials that he would testify, and then the day before he ended up canceling his testimony. So I kind of doubt that Trump will testify, but we won't really know until the prosecution rests its case.
And looking ahead to the end of the trial, what are the stakes here? What could a conviction mean?
So there are 34 felony counts. If Trump is convicted, each one carries a maximum sentence of 4 years in prison, but there's no minimum sentence. required. And it's kind of unlikely that a first-time nonviolent offender like Trump would be, would get sentenced to prison. So I really doubt Trump would see the inside of a jail cell because of this trial. That being said, if he's very unruly at the trial, if he acts out, behaves badly, violates a gag order that the judge imposed on him, which governs what he can say about jurors and witnesses, then he could be in for a surprise here.
And in any case, though, legal troubles so far for Mr. Trump have seemed only really to help him when it comes to the polling anyway. What do you think all of this means, if anything, for the upcoming elections?
So I don't think it will have a huge effect. This behavior that's alleged here has been known about since 2018. So Americans are really kind of inured to it. They're inured to Donald Trump's sex scandals. A plurality tell pollsters that they think this will have no bearing on his political career in November. They think it's the least serious of the four indictments that he faces. Americans either love Donald Trump or they hate him, and there just aren't that many persuadable people at this point. A criminal conviction in a fairly unserious case isn't going to change that.
Thanks very much for your time, Kenneth.
Thanks for having me.
Years ago today, there was a show by the Anonymous Society of Painters, Sculptors, Printmakers, etc. that opened in Paris.
Alexandra Sewage Bass is The Economist's culture editor.
It was an attempt to push against the established orthodoxy of painting and art of the time. And the people who came together to put on this show had a very revolutionary style. It's known to us today and beloved by us today, but many at the time did not appreciate it. One painting called Impression Sunrise by Claude Monet was sneered at by the critic Louis Leroy. Wallpaper in its embryonic state is more finished than that seascape. It's a painting of the port Normandy, now considered a masterpiece by Monet. And it's an example of just how far we've come in our understanding and appreciation of Impressionists. So now the Musée d'Orsay in Paris is putting on a show that is honoring the 1874 show. It's called Paris, 1874, Inventing Impressionism, and I got to see it. It was a really fascinating show because it tries to recreate the original Impressionist exhibition from 1874 by bringing together a lot of the paintings that were exhibited there. And they are paired alongside the paintings that were shown in the government-sponsored salon. Those are much more traditional. They show scenes of myth and history, classical portraits. And in the Anonymous Society show, there were some really revolutionary works like Monet's. There was one that was extremely shocking by Paul Cézanne of Olympia, depicting a prostitute in a brothel and a man looking on.
C'est le lieu où se déroule actuellement le salon.
Paired with this show is a VR show. People who come can go to a separate room, don a headset, and walk through the 1874 exhibition, both the official salon and the Anonymous Society show. It's really a fascinating use of technology. I think probably one of the most successful attempts by a museum to use technology to enhance our understanding of art history and the past, because you're able to walk by these paintings and hear from the artist directly of what they were intending. You really have a sense of being there and what it might have felt like. Looking at the paintings, I think it's possible to see a lot of resonances to today. Impressionists were capturing a changing landscape. They rejected the romantic notion that landscape should be pure and idealized. They were showing how nature was being altered by technology. They were also living in an extremely uncertain time amidst conflict in the aftermath of war. France had just been defeated in the Franco-Prussian War. There had been civil unrest in Paris.
The way in which the Impressionists deliberately or maybe unconsciously erase anything having to do with the war in their painting, you know, they turn their attention to happy scenes of modern life, is intriguing.
Anne Robbins is the co-curator of the exhibition at the Musée d'Orsay.
It had an impact on each of their lives and careers, and yet they do not deal with this in the painting. And I think it's interesting if you think of COVID being so recent and how quickly we managed to forget everything about it.
They were also reacting to new technologies. The innovation of portable paint and tubes helped them paint outside, which is why we see these vibrant landscapes that were painted au plein air rather than in their studios, which was quite revolutionary at the time. They are painting in the shadow of photography, which had recently been invented. And many think that that is why the bold brush strokes are there. They are reacting to photography rather than trying to replicate photography's clarity and compete with photography through painting. They are trying to claim it and show how different their work can be. The exhibition shows how few artists who showed in the 1874 Impressionist Salon are remembered today. There were about 7 Impressionist artists that still have name recognition, from Berthe Morisot to Paul Cézanne to Claude Monet. When we look at the contemporary art world today, we're seeing young artists fetch 6 figures, sometimes 7 figures for works. But there will be a similar sorting inevitably 50 years from now, and certainly 150 years from now, where many of the artists that people know will have faded into obscurity. And it's a humbling reminder walking around the show about how many artists were lost to history.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.